From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since the time of the dinosaurs, there have been wildfires. Mother Earth has put them to good use over the ages. But this summer's early and roaring outbreak of big wildfires across the West has everyone's attention. We long thought we could suppress, control wildfire. Can we still? In an era of overgrown undergrowth, drought, development, and climate change, this hour on Point, what can we learn from the explosive early season of Western wildfires? You can join the conversation. Have you seen them? Have you survived them? Are we into a new era of wildfire? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the bulletin TV viewers in the Denver area heard last night on NBC affiliate 9 News as firefighters slowly got the upper hand on the Waldo Canyon fire and Colorado Springs residents began to return to their homes.
Tonight, 7,000 people are home after some evacuation orders are lifted from the Waldo Canyon fire. We cannot ever forget those images from Colorado Springs on Tuesday night as home after home was devoured by flames. Crews are making progress on the active flames still burning within the fire perimeter. They've now reached 55% containment. The fire has burned more than 17,000 acres, destroying 346 homes on 34 different streets. More than 1,500 firefighters continue their work tonight.
That is a lot of destruction. And are we seeing something different here? Here's Colorado firefighter and biologist Tim Sullivan in an interview last week with USA Today saying that there are forest fires and then there are these forest fires.
They're fires that burn incredibly hot, incredibly destructively, and across tens of thousands of acres. And these are fires that we have really never seen in the historical record. Scientists have gone back, and while fire is common, fires of this scale and size and destructiveness are not common.
Colorado firefighter Tim Sullivan. Joining me first today from Denver, Colorado, is Megan Verlies. She's a reporter for Colorado Public Radio and has been covering the fires in her state, especially the Waldo Canyon fire on Colorado Springs. Megan, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi.
So we saw everybody heading out of town and those fires so big in the mountains and coming right into communities, all the houses flattened. Where do things stand now? Are they out of the heavily populated areas at least, Megan, or not?
Well, we're enjoying a couple days of respite, I guess you could call it. We've had cooler weather, calmer winds across the state. We're starting, hopefully everybody's got their fingers crossed, to move into a pattern of summer moisture. And so a lot of the fires that have been burning across the state, they've been making really good progress on. As you heard in that tape you played, people in Colorado Springs are getting to go back into a lot of these neighborhoods, and we're starting to get those pictures of just utter devastation in the neighborhoods that were hit. But fingers crossed, we seem to be in a slightly better place where instead of getting, you know, huge acreage updates every day of more things burning, we're starting to get updates of more containment lines going in.
30,000 plus people evacuated. Have you ever seen anything like that before in Colorado?
No. I mean, I think we're very well aware of the danger of fire, and we're very well aware of what it can do to these rural neighborhoods up in the mountains. But this was in the city. If you look at the aerial photos of the area that was hit, these are cul-de-sacs. This is a suburban, you know, edge of urban neighborhood. And I was actually in the midst of the evacuation quite by accident on Tuesday, on the main interstate that people were trying to get on. And it was a parking lot. It looked like a scene out of, I kept thinking of like the prologue to a Terminator movie. The smoke was so bad that it looked like it was almost night. Yeah. Exactly. And one of the local TV stations was streaming on the radio. I was listening to them, and they were just begging people. Apparently, people on the highway were stopping and taking pictures. It was hard not to. The sun was just this orange ball, and it was very, very ominous. And they were begging people to stop taking pictures and start moving because, you know, about 20,000 people were trying to get out of this neighborhood with flames literally coming up behind them.
What kind of lessons do you hear people in Colorado and Colorado Springs and beyond taking from this? I mean, that's a lot of homes. Everyone's going to stare at those flattened, burned out places, just nothing left. You know, what gives people confidence they can go back, move in, and it won't be the same thing next year or even later this summer?
Well, I think, you know, I think people are trying to figure out what lesson to take. With a normal, you know, normal being a relative term, wildfire, when it takes out homes in what we call the wildland-urban interface, the WUI, you know, the lesson, there's a lot of talk about mitigation and should people be building up there and do we need statewide building codes, which we don't have for those areas. But with this one, you know, I've been sort of hearing a lot of soul searching. what do you do when fire comes into the city? This isn't necessarily a scenario. I know the city of Colorado Springs has actually been preparing for this for a long time, but this is a different order of magnitude, and I think people are struggling to figure out what lesson do you take at this point.
We heard news reporters remarking on, looking at all the equipment out there and how puny it looked in relation to the scale of these fires, Megan.
Certainly on Tuesday when the Waldo Canyon fire broke blew up, I don't think anything on a human scale was going to stop it. This fire hit 65-mile-an-hour winds, and it just poured down the mountainsides into this neighborhood. What you hear people talking about is that at that point is not the point where you stop the fire. You stop the fire a year earlier, months earlier, when you're doing fire mitigation up in the wildland area so that there aren't the fuels out there for this fire to reach that point. But once it's at that point, you know, and people, the commanders kept saying this over and over, their priority was to get people out alive. The houses are not the priority at that point. You're trying to get the crews out, you're trying to get the residents out, but you're not stopping the fire at that point.
Here's Colorado Springs resident Susan Reynolds, interviewed by 9 News yesterday. She and her family were allowed to return home over the weekend. Her house survived, but she wept for her neighbors whose homes were just mounds of warm ashes.
I cried. It's sad, you know, because you walk that all the time, you know, with your family and your dogs. Your just heart goes out to those families. So we're just so incredibly blessed.
Sue Reynolds' family, lucky their house is there, many other houses not there. Megan Verlee is with us from Colorado Public Radio in Denver. With us right now as well from Boise, Idaho, is Bill Coggi. He's a wildland fire director for the National Park Service, member of the National Multi-Agency Coordinating Group, NMAC, at the National Interagency Fire Center. They get on top of these fires, and there have been plenty to track. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. So we heard Tim Sullivan, Colorado firefighter biologist, saying, you know, what's different here is the scale and size and destructiveness of the fires we're seeing, and so early this year. How do you look at the month we've just had of wildfire in June, Bill?
Well, if you look at the month in comparison to months past and the total acres burned across the country, we're actually a little bit behind in acres burned compared to the 10-year average, although we are catching up. And we've had much less ignitions than normal. But drought has been across the southern tier of the country. And certainly when you look at the southwest, when you look at the Rocky Mountain, the Front Range, they've experienced more than their fair share of fire this early in the fire season.
Why do you think it's come so early this year, Bill? What's going on there?
Well, I don't know that it has come early, Tom. It always starts down in the southern tier of the country, and fire kind of sweeps northward with the changing of the seasons. So it's fairly typical for Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona to be in their fire season April, May, June, and then with the monsoonal flow, with that push of moisture up out of the Gulf of Mexico, they kind of cool off, but it shifts lightning further northward into Montana, et cetera, as the season moves into July and August.
I mean, here we are, though. People are talking about the snowpack being light this year, a light snowfall, therefore not as much runoff, therefore more vulnerability. Are you buying that equation, Bill?
Yeah, actually, we talked about it in NMAC over the weekend, and our predictive services individual, Jeremy, kind of laid the groundwork looking at it a different way. He said, you know, we haven't had the snowpack in many areas of the countries that we traditionally get, and the fine fuels aren't compacted, and the ignitions that we've had have been in a very receptive, what we call a fuel bed or vegetation that's allowed for large fires to occur, and we haven't had many fires in the north part of the country the last couple of years, so he actually expects it to be fairly normal to have large fires into Montana, Wyoming, in the Great Basin area over the July-August period.
What makes that receptive fuel bed, as you describe it, that kind of tinderbox in the forest? Why?
Think drought, and we haven't had the snowpack. We traditionally are adding in the summer months where we don't get rainfall, but we do have lightning ignitions from thunder cell development as well as human-caused ignitions. And when it's very, very dry, if you have an ignition and what I call a receptive fuel bed or receptive fuels, it's very easy for a fire to start. And they're getting big this year, I think, because of that lack of compaction in the grasslands, in the low elevation fuels. It's allowing for fires to get large fairly quickly this year.
Are we having to change our attitude about the fire suppression and control here? Are we getting to a scale of fire that's just not controllable, Bill?
The environment's always changing, and that's the natural environment and the human element associated with it. We're moving out into the wildlands. We'll see what the economic outlook, what it's caused in terms of development in that wildland-urban interface that Megan mentioned. But, you know, the vast majority of our fires right now are human-caused fires. And as people push out into the hinterlands, into the natural environment, there's a much greater chance of ignitions occurring.
Of course, Megan, it sounds as though you're talking to people who are wondering if that push into the hinterlands can continue up against the face of these kind of fires, Megan.
You certainly hear people talk about that. I don't think anybody's quite found a fix yet. It actually, to me, it reminds me of the trouble we have with healthcare. Everybody can go to an emergency room whether or not you have health insurance. In the same way, you can build in these wildland interfaces, and the government is required to try and protect your home. And we haven't found a way to shift the risk and the cost of that firefighting onto people who live up there yet. It's not politically popular in my state, certainly. And until somebody finds a way to make the risk land on the people up there, we're going to see more development because it's a gorgeous place to live until it burns.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about what we're learning from the early summer wildfires in the West this year. There have been plenty, and the whole world sort of watching, kind of slack-jawed at just how big they appear to be and how early they've come. Of course, my guest Bill Coggi in Boise, Idaho, says, yes, fires come early, and there are particular reasons with that receptive fuel bed this year and drought and a low snowpack that is light snow this year, so we don't have that coming down. Megan Verlee is with us from Denver, Colorado, with Colorado Public Radio. Bill, talk to us about how do you battle fires on this scale. What kind of equipment does it take, and what about the observations that there are times, you know, reporters look at this and say, boy, that equipment looks very small up against what we're fighting.
Well, firefighting starts locally with the relationships you have between volunteer fire departments, state government, local government, and federal government. And it's all geared towards addressing it at that local level.
But you've got the National Guard called in here, calls for more big tanker planes from all over the place, don't you?
We do, and we start locally, and if the fires escape and we're not successful with our initial strategy, we'll bump it up regionally to call in additional resources. And then if they're having trouble even staffing, meeting the needs regionally, it'll come up to us at NMAC, the National Multi-Agency Coordinating Group, for assignment of resources that we manage at the national level. So it's pretty well coordinated across the three levels. And it's true, there's a wide variety of tools that we use and have in the toolbox, and it just depends upon the fire, you know, the particular fire that we're dealing with and the strategy we're employing, what tools we use.
Megan, I see people who have been right in the middle of this, it sounds like beginning to doubt whether we've got the tools to get on top of it. This is the Denver Post quoting Scott Campbell with the El Paso County. He's the fire management officer there, Colorado Springs. He says, we don't expect people to stand on the beach to stop a hurricane. Every other natural disaster, we have the good sense to get out of the way, but we've had such a strong fire service and such a strong message over the years that we've actually convinced a lot of people that we have control over this natural disaster. He sounds skeptical about that now, Megan.
And I think he's got a right to be. It's sort of interesting. One of the big tools in the toolbox is prescribed burning, you know, coming in and clearing out areas with fire in a very controlled way. But they no longer call it controlled burns because they don't want to give people the false sense that those can't escape. And I think that it is becoming a louder question in this state, certainly, as you look at the maps of these very large fires. And I actually heard one fire scientist describe it as looking like puzzle pieces starting to fit in together along the Front Range, where mm-hmm. we have had a lot of development in the wildland-urban interface. People are starting to question, what do you do to get a handle on this. But the political will so far has not been there to do the wide-scale mitigation, the very, very large prescribed burns that, and I don't think the funding has necessarily been there either, that mm-hmm. would probably really be needed to long-term get our forests to a much healthier place where when they burn, they're burning in a healthier way.
Let's hear from our listeners in the region. Laramie, Wyoming, Elizabeth is calling. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for calling in from Wyoming. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to actually comment. I heard on the news this morning about 30 miles south of Laramie, where I am, near Medicine Bow Wildlife Area, they have actually recommended evacuations because of a new fire that sparked down there. And I did notice that even this morning I can smell, it smells like wood burning. Even it started basically last, I'd say really early this morning, probably around 5 o'clock when I got up. But yeah, it's been really awful out here. And I was just down in Denver a little while ago, and we drove through, we took 287 south through Fort Collins, and the smoke was just unbelievable.
Does it feel like we're, does it still feel manageable somehow, Elizabeth? I mean, we look on, you're living there. You've got the smell of it in your nostrils. We look on from afar and historically have thought, well, okay, we'll get on top of this. Does it still feel that way to you in Wyoming?
It feels, I mean, people definitely respond. I think, I mean, people are responding as and doing as much as they possibly can. Here in Laramie, I think it's a little bit different for us because I noticed that we only get the smell of the smoke really when the winds change and shift a certain way. I can't imagine being down in Fort Collins, although I have friends that live down there and they say it's not. I mean, they've had a bunch of, you know, summer festivals and brew festivals and things, and they still go out and they say it's not as bad. I mean, I don't
know. I mean, life goes on until it doesn't,
yeah.
Until the fire
yeah,
comes.
So it does, yep.
Until it comes down. Elizabeth in Laramie, Wyoming, thanks very much for calling. Let me get one more voice in our conversation from Flagstaff, Arizona. Wallace Wally Covington is with us. He's director of the Ecological Restoration Institute at North Arizona University. Science Magazine calls him maybe the most visible forest scientist in the country. Wally Covington, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What do you see going on with these fires? The coverage has been, you know, with a lot of exclamation marks after it, and the numbers have been eye-popping. Are we on some kind of arc here, some kind of curve? Where is it taking us, Wally?
Yeah, we've been on this arc, as you call it, for some time now. So, you know, fires under natural conditions in these dry forest types, like the Waldo Canyon fire, burned fairly frequently, once every 2 to maybe 15 years, mm-hmm. and they were maintenance fires. They controlled the buildup of fuels, they recycled nutrients, they restored wildlife habitat and kept healthy watersheds. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, we started disrupting these natural fire regimes. And we did that first with overgrazing and then secondarily with active fire suppression. And once those frequent fires were eliminated in these dry forest types, then population explosions of vegetation occurred. Shrubs, but especially trees in the long-needle pine type, the dry mix conifer type.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened over the past 100 years is these trees have gotten bigger and bigger. The landscape has become more fully filled in so that now we've got a fuel bed that is unprecedented in evolutionary time. So that has set up the conditions for what we've got today. Socially, what's happening is people my age,
mm-hmm.
I'm retirement age, who have enough money are building nice homes back up in nature.
Up against that fuel bed.
Right up against it. So it is a train wreck, two trains coming together. One of them is unnatural landscape scale fuel conditions, and the other train is this social train. That is, we want to live in nature. We're tired of living in the cities. We've worked hard. We're retiring. And so let's build our dream home back up in the backcountry.
What about the third piece, if you see it there, the drought, the low snowpack, maybe even a climate element here? How do you look at that?
Well, the climate is a third driver. And although there have been climate fluctuations going back for tens of millions of years mm-hmm. in these types, the kinds of changes that we're seeing now are unusual. And they are pretty clearly associated with greenhouse gases associated with fossil fuel burning primarily. So this climate change is now giving us much steeper gradients between lows and highs so that we have very high wind speeds. We have a boom and bust of very dry years where things can burn hot and very wet years where a lot of fuels can accumulate. So it's kind of like a pumping action in a way of wet years accumulate a lot of fuel, dry years burn that fuel up, and at scales that are beyond our capability to really effectively control them.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I was quoting to Bill Coggy and Megan Everly here, Scott Campbell, who is the fire management officer in El Paso County, so in the middle of all the Colorado Springs stuff, saying, look, we don't expect people to stand on the beach to stop a hurricane. I mean, are we at the point with all those factors, Wally, that the expectation of stopping these fire giants is unreasonable?
Well, the real trick is to get at them early.
And if but obviously we don't always do. I mean, we don't.
Yeah, when we don't, they're going to burn till they run out of fuel or the weather changes. Now, the solution to this is to get out there and do restoration-based fuel treatments before the fires actually occur.
What does that mean?
So this would involve mechanically removing the excess young trees and shrubs that have come in since fire exclusion over the past 100 years.
Is that practical to do that mechanically and not by combustion?
It is, especially if you have some way to utilize the biomass that's generated. And this can occur very effectively in the ponderosa pine, Jeffrey pine, dry mix conifer type. There's all kinds of modern engineered wood products that can use this material. Another opportunity is to use
that biomass.
In other
words, it makes it economical. You can sort of pay for the operation using what's in there, the undergrowth.
Yeah, you can help offset the cost. Mm-hmm. But you know, the thing about it is we don't want to lose civilian lives. We don't want to lose firefighter lives, and we don't want to lose property, including infrastructure, not just houses, but mm-hmm. radio towers and so on. So what goes begging is the ecosystem at large, you know, the critical wildlife habitat that's so important for many threatened and endangered
sure.
species. So there's a lot that needs to be done. The only way that we can see doing that is with preventive restoration treatments, just like in medicine. You got to do preventive medicine. You don't want everyone showing up at the hospital, at the emergency room. That's just too expensive.
But on what
this
scale?
This is preventative, preventive yeah. ecosystem medicine, maybe is what you'd call it.
On a very big scale. Larry in Lexington, Kentucky. Thanks for calling, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just calling as a comment about the hype that's generated. You know, in the 20s, 30s, and early 40s, I combined tens of millions of acres burned. And it's only just now bad news because so many people have chosen to take up residence in fuel-rich environments.
Yeah.
It is mostly sad for the endangered species. But, you know, partly I think it's just kind of the price of the American dream, so to speak, for choosing to reside in such fuel-rich environments.
Yeah, right by the forest when it's dry and packed with fuel. Bill Coggy, there's the ecosystem management here, and we'll look more at that, but what about once they get started, and we've seen them get started year after year and just this last month, I mean, is there more that can be done, I don't know, with equipment or technologically or logistics-wise, once you've got this, you know, humans right up against?
Well, I'll add to what Wally said, Tom. He's correct. We have to do more to really create, maintain, and enhance those healthy and resilient ecosystems. And whether you do that through mechanical manipulation that Wally talked about or through the use of fire, there's plenty of tools in the toolbox to help us with that. But I think that probably one of the biggest things that we should also talk about is that people have to expect that when they live near the wildlands, they're living with fire, and we have to take ownership of that fact as individuals living in those communities. Working with government at the local, regional, and national level.
But how do you do it individually when that big fire is coming down the mountainside? It's kind of too late for individuals.
Like Wally said, you know, if you're an owner of property, you have a responsibility to remove vegetation from around your home to make sure that your home is resilient to fire, that you've helped create that fire adapted community, and that you're working with your fire departments to make sure you have good ingress and egress to get to your home. So there's lots of things that you can do, that we can do working together to create fire-adapted communities, because fire is part of the environment, and it's here to stay as long as we're on Mother Earth. And you just have to recognize that fact.
Boy, once it hits the neighborhood, it's kind of tough. But, yes, lots of planning can be done in advance. Mindy in Missoula, Montana. Mindy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is that the West is a fire-dependent ecosystem, and for hundreds of years, fires would burn. The problem is people moving into the wildland interface, and living in a fire community, I know that it is not worth risking lives of firefighters to save these trophy homes up in the canyons. Mm. So I think that we need to get back to prescribed and preventive forestry measures.
How do you do that politically, Mindy, when you've got people living? I mean, once the houses are built and people are there, they may not be too crazy about quote-unquote controlled fires around them to manage the undergrowth.
This is true, but when people come into areas expanding out of cities like Missoula and Colorado Springs and Hamilton, Montana, they need to be educated that they're moving into fire zones. And unless they put in fire suppression systems in their own homes, why should we risk the lives of our firefighters who do phenomenal work?
Yeah, no, I hear it loud and clear. I appreciate your call, Mindy, there from Missoula. Megan, I mean, can you, once it gets started, can you imagine communities saying, well, we know we shouldn't be here or we should have done something different. Don't bring on the firefighters?
Well, what you actually hear from the firefighters themselves is that they are doing triage up in those neighborhoods. If they go in there and there's a house that has, you know, a whole bunch of trees that have been dumping needles on the roof for years, and that homeowner hasn't been clearing those those needles away and clearing the tree away, and they've got a big stack of wood right up against the house, the firefighters are going to move on and try and defend the home down the road that has defensible space, that has a safe roof, because it's dangerous for them to try and defend an unmitigated house. And so, you know, fire crews don't want to really publicly admit, especially because they are part of these communities. These volunteer firemen are often defending their homes and their neighbors' homes. But for their own safety, they're going to the houses that are mitigated. And to go back to kind of these causal factors, I think one real problem here, and all of us in the West are to some extent guilty of it, is that a fire-safe landscape does not look like the West we love and imagine. A fire-safe landscape has a lot fewer trees on it. You know, we love these big, thick forests, but they're not healthy. They're not safe. These cabins in the woods, you know, I drive through the mountains now, and I would say 19 out of 20 homes I see have all these nice trees around them. And that's what you want with your mountain
that
cabin.
Yosemite,
you want privacy.
Poster. And, yeah.
Exactly. But that's not a fire-safe home. A fire-safe home is sitting in a really big clearing. And so I think for us, our expectations about what the mountains are like are going to have to change. I heard from somebody in the Forest Service who said that explorers used to complain that the Rocky Mountains were really smoky in the summer. You know, they were coming through in the 18th century, and they hated all that smoke because the mountains were naturally burning. Well, you move up to the mountains now, you expect clean, fresh air. You don't want the Forest Service filling your skies with smoke every summer, but that, again, is what a healthy landscape looks like. And so I think for us who live out here, there are expectations about our landscape that have to change, and that's a very deep and very difficult process that I don't think we've really addressed yet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what we are learning from the early summer wildfires in the West this year. You've seen the images, the evacuations, the number of houses, 350 nearly, just around Colorado Springs. Megan Verlee is with us from Colorado Public Radio in Denver. Bill Coggy's here for a few more minutes from Boise, Idaho, Wildland Fire Director for the National Park Service. And Wally Covington's with us from North Arizona University, head of the Ecological Restoration Institute there. Jim is on the highway from Nebraska to Colorado calling in. Jim, watch the road, but thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, one of the things that I haven't heard addressed yet is the beetle kill problem that's been in the Rocky Mountains. I think millions of acres have been affected by that, and so you could see whole hillsides and mountainsides that are just dead timber. And I would suspect that that's a major portion of the magnitude and the heat magnitude of these fires. Jim, I'd like to hear what your panel has to say about that.
You've got it, Jim. I appreciate your call from the highway to Colorado there. We've done shows right here on the beetle kill, but Wally Covington, what about it? We've seen the images of whole mountainsides kind of look just bleached out for dead trees tending from beetles. What's driving the big beetle kill? How big a factor is that?
Well, a couple of answers. First, the beetle kill is natural in some forest types, like lodgepole pine. It occurs periodically and kills large areas. In the frequent fire forests like ponderous pine, Jeffrey pine, beetle kill is not natural under natural conditions. It's when you get overly dense forests like have developed since settlement that we start seeing big outbreaks of pine beetles. Now, with respect to the fire situation, when the needles are still red and on beetle-killed trees, mm-hmm. whether they be lodgepole pine or ponderosa pine, there is an increased fire risk. There's no doubt about it, of a crown fire developing. Those needles don't stay on the trees very long. Once they fall to the ground, then you're not likely to – well, you won't see crown fires. Instead, what you'll see is surface fires burning along the surface. Now, those fires can be very severe with their impacts on the soil, and they can generate a lot of smoke, but they're typically pretty slow-moving fires.
Now, the unnatural beetle kill you're describing from overly dense forests, overly dense because of previous decades' fire suppression efforts, Wally?
That's right. So, you know, with not just fire suppression, but fire exclusion. The earliest fire exclusion was by heavy livestock grazing, which removed mm-hmm. the grasses and wildflowers that allowed fire to sweep across the landscape. Fire suppression didn't really start actively until 30 to 40 years after the heavy livestock grazing in the West.
How did Native Americans manage with wildfire when they were the population of the West?
Well, it varied. You know, we come from Homo sapiens in general, all of us, are masters of fire culturally. And we used fire to manage the landscapes for as long as we've been around. And then different groups have had different technologies to use fire, whether you're talking about the Aboriginal people of Australia, African people, or the peoples of the Americas. So they have widely varying techniques for burning fire and very sophisticated fire technology. They used it to actually cultivate land extensively.
Did they do controlled burns or the equivalent?
Yes, they did prescribe burns. So they would set fires to achieve specific goals, for example, to create habitat to grow vegetables and plants. They would burn to create yarding areas, what they call yarding areas, places where deer or elk will accumulate, or bison, where they'd be easier to hunt. So they used fires to burn areas around the places where they lived to protect their lodges mm-hmm. or from fire. So we have a lot that we could learn from the way Native people have lived with fire in a broad range of vegetation types.
Bill Cockey, talk to us about the crown fires that Wally's referring to there and how those are more dangerous. That gets us into the potentially the firestorm dynamic. What's a crown fire? How's that different from a healthier, if that's the right word, fire, Bill?
Well, like Wally said, there are ecosystems. Lodgepole pine ecosystem is an example that experiences crown fire. That's what's supposed to occur in that type of environment in comparison to a lower elevation ponderosa pine forest where you see more periodic surface fire that occurs on a more regular basis, and you don't see it in the crown.
So the surface fire would what, clear out the undergrowth without killing off the big canopy, the big trees above?
Yeah, or it may kill off some of them, but the majority of the large diameter, large trees would survive, and you'd get regeneration, regrowth from the seedlings, from the cones from those large trees.
And is a crown fire harder to fight? What happens there?
I would say while it's certainly predictable, there's a lot more need to stand off and leave fire run its course. You can't get out in front of a Crown Fire with people, with equipment, safely at all, and you need to go back to the basics of anchor and flank, where you're fighting the fire, kind of controlling or herding the fire from the rear. And there's just, think of it, would you rather stand in front of a 1 or 2 foot flame ranks, or would you rather stand in front of 200 foot flame ranks, and how far away do you have to be from 1 or 2 foot flame ranks in comparison to 200 foot flame ranks?
A 200 foot flame is pretty daunting. Have we seen a bunch of Crown Fire this June, Bill?
Tom, I'm not sure that we have. I know you may ask Wally about that. There has been Crown Fire, but a lot of the fire has been burning in the lower elevation forests and grasslands, shrublands. And I haven't seen or heard large reports of extensive Crown Fire runs, but he may be able, or Megan may be able to speak to that more with what they're seeing in Colorado.
Megan, what about it in Colorado this last month? Crown fires, we've seen the talk about the vortex and stuff you just can't get in front of, as Bill says.
That's, I've heard a lot of descriptions of fires crowning, so I think we are getting those, especially, as they're saying, when they're up in the higher elevations before they come down. I mean, one thing I found amazing about the Waldo Canyon fire, and I'm not quite sure how the flame lengths relate to this, is they were getting embers blown a mile in front of the fire. They had embers that actually crossed a very large reservoir. And, I think you need pretty good flame lengths to get that picked up and carried that distance. And when you've got something like that, it does, it sort of boggles the mind to imagine how you fight something that is spotting out in front up to a mile.
Is that dry fuel bed, Wally, that receptive fuel bed, make a higher under fire that gets up in the crown? Is it happening more because of that?
It does. And another thing in relation to what Megan was talking about, in getting we talk about fire spread and fire growth. So fire spread is where fire is burning into adjacent unburned vegetation. Fire growth occurs when you have embers raised in the atmosphere and blown over, and you get another fire out in front of it. That sort of situation is kind of a worst-case scenario for firefighting. So the embers are drawn up into the atmosphere, not under the very high wind conditions. These are typically under moderate wind speeds where you get big plumes, and we've all seen these on the news, if not in person, big plumes developing, and you get the embers swept up into these big cumulus clouds that are made by the fire.
Yeah.
When that plume collapses, then winds are blown out sometimes 60, 70 miles an hour, 80 miles an hour in all directions, and blows these burning embers way out of the fire, the normal fire line. So that's kind of the worst case scenario, and that's where you get that typically occurs on very large fires. It's common in the boreal forest, the spruce fir forest of Alaska and Siberia and Canada. But we're now seeing this in the lower 48 in forests that have never had these crown fires before. So in a way, we've got these unnatural, large spruce fir type forests occurring down in our what should be light surface, frequent surface fire force.
Bill, I know I've just got you for another minute here. I'm reading Denver Post again, firefighter Lisa Smith coming into these areas where the fire has been so bad, saying it's indescribable, she says. It looked like an atomic bomb had gone off. And you talk about what needs to be done around and in advance of fire. Wally was talking about what earlier human cultures have done, bringing different technologies to bear. With all these homes now and these ripe conditions, is there new technology or new logistics? Is there some kind of big hammer we could bring down on these fires that we haven't to date?
I don't really think so, Tom. It still gets back to the basics, I think, of leadership, effective collaboration, working with each other collectively, in the planning stage, politically, to really learn to live with fire and then respond appropriately. We're used to working together in the wildland fire arena with amongst ourselves with our structure fire brothers, and there's not a lot of tools in the toolbox, and I think that's okay because you're dealing with something very elemental. It's been around forever, and we may need to adjust how we look at it and learn to live with it. There's, you know, the unmanned aerial drones. There's greater use of technology to collect data and analyze the data, but the on-the-ground fire management, once a fire occurs, it still comes down to the men and women who are out there working together to manage the fire and working with our law enforcement counterparts,
yeah.
or people who are engaged in the effort, whether response or evacuations.
Though in these past weeks, we've seen those moments when it was just they just weren't making progress. Elemental, absolutely, and learn to live with it, maybe, but it's on a lot of doorsteps now, really gets people's attention. Bill Coggi at the National Park Service there, the Wildland Fire Director, joining us from Boise, Idaho. Thanks so much for your insights today, Bill.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Margaret in Hampton, Virginia. Margaret, you're on the air.
I just want to point out, although I understand there are many factors producing these fires, it would behoove us to consider the big picture, and by that I mean the environmental component, specifically global warming. As I understand it, part of the problem has been the drought in the area, as well as the warm winter, which allowed the beetles to survive. I just want to comment, too, weather, in my opinion, does seem to be changing around the nation. I know here in Tidewater, we've had consistently extremely hot days, and I've lived here for 40 years. I've never seen it like this.
Mm-hmm.
And tornadoes, which I have never seen until the last couple of years.
And severe storms just in the last few days and a mass power outage around that. Margaret, let me take it to Wally Covington. I mean, we looked at it, but let's look again, Wally, just how big a factor this is. Climate change and, you know, people all around the country feel like they're seeing different patterns of temperature and precipitation. We've talked about drought and very low snowpack, snowfall. How big a role do you think that plays in what we've seen?
Well, it's definitely happening. I don't think there's any scientific question that we're seeing climate change and that man's actions are playing a big role in that. And the climate change that we're seeing is warming. We're seeing earlier springs, later falls. We're seeing, like I mentioned earlier, hotter hots, colder colds, windier, windy days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely happening. Now, one of the things, though, that we've got to realize is that we've had wide swings in climatic conditions going back as far as reconstructed records allow us to go for tens of millions of years. So we've had some changes. 40 million years ago, for example, the carbon dioxide concentration was estimated to be about 1,100 parts per million compared to today's about 380 parts per million.
Wow.
So we've had very high CO2 concentrations. We've had all these wide swings in the past. What we've never had before, though, is unnatural conditions in these dry forest types like we have today. We've never had people living in the landscape and building houses that are burnable houses. They're not mm-hmm. houses that
not
are meant to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that can stand up to fire. So it is a different situation. There is a way out of this, and I think this ecological restoration approach is probably the way to do it, certainly in the frequent fire forest. If you're going to build in a lodgepole pine forest or a spruce fir forest, it's basically a roll of the dice. You know that it's going to burn and burn like hell at some point in the next century or two, depending on how old the forest is. However, in the frequent fire forest, we can restore conditions where fires can be put out very easily with back burning through the grasses, they will not be the kind of threat that we're seeing today.
Megan, how do you think Coloradans are taking this on board? I mean, when Bill Cuggy talks about things getting beyond our technology, you know, talking about how we have to learn to live with it up against the images we've seen from the past week, that sounds like a pretty frightening prospect. What does a society do that's living just the way we're describing?
You know, it's funny. Everybody says, when you talk to people who live up there, everybody says, well, you know, you live with the risk of fire. People in the mountains have learned to live with the risk of fire. But when the fire is actually bearing down on your home, people want it saved. You know,
and whole neighborhoods.
Well, exactly. And there's an immense emotional tie and a financial tie. I mean, people lose millions of dollars in property up there when these fires come through. And so, you know, we're still at this stage where there's a disconnect between what we know rationally, which is that these landscapes burn. And right now, because of the forest conditions, they burn in a sterilizing, terrible way.
Mm-hmm.
And our emotional desire to just save my neighborhood, because there are successes. There are houses that survive these fires. There are neighborhoods that survive these fires. And so we haven't bridged that disconnect yet between what we know and what we want.
Wally, we just got a 20 seconds here. Do you think we'll see a change in population patterns of residents in the West?
Maybe so. You know, I kind of doubt that that's likely. The more likely scenario is that we're going to be able to maybe get in and restore some of these frequent fire forests so they won't be such a liability to current and future generations.
Get them on a different pattern of burning and maybe a less sterilizing pattern, as Megan says. Wally Covington with the Ecological Restoration Institute at North Arizona University, joining us from Flagstaff, Arizona today. Wally, thank you very much for your insights. We appreciate them.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And Megan Verlee with Colorado Public Radio, joining us from Denver. Megan, you're terrific. Thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you, Tom.
Good luck to everybody out there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.